Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On this week's episode, Majora's Mask, Undertale, and Sia. This week sees the re-release of one of the greatest video games ever made, Majora's Mask, which is about a young boy trying to stop the end of the world. In commemoration, we're diving into the Sewers of Paris archives yet again for a chat about the game with a man who's given a lot of thought to impending apocalypses, both as an adult and as a child. That may be a dark obsession for a little kid, but playing through the end of the world at video games got Enrique through some tough times as a kid, and even tougher times as an adult. Also, listeners, I know we've been dipping into the Sewers of Paris archives more than usual lately, and that's because I've been working on two new top-secret projects that made it a little difficult to record interviews over the last few weeks. But here's the good news. After this week, you can look forward to a bunch of brand new Sewers of Paris conversations, and I'll be announcing those two exciting new projects very soon. One's directly connected to Sewers of Paris, and the other is sort of a companion to both Sewers and my YouTube channel. Thanks for your patience, and I cannot wait for you to see what I've been working on these last few weeks. Now, on with the episode and my 2016 conversation with Enrique. Hello, and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. Today I'm speaking to Enrique of House Quintero. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
So, what's the entertainment that changed your life?
Undertale. Have you heard of it?
I've heard the name, and I know that all the Tumblrs are talking about it right now, and I haven't played it yet.
I'd say that it could have changed my life. It could easily be the best game I've ever played, and I've played a lot of games. Ever since I finished it, it's vying for that number one spot.
So tell me what it is.
It's this indie RPG. It's adorable. It was made by this guy named Toby Fox, who is a music composer, but he started dabbling into game design. And have you ever played the Earthbound series? So there's Earthbound. They just recently released in America Earthbound Zero. And there's Mother 3 that sadly hasn't been released. It's very quirky, very simplistic. And this was actually inspired by that series of very quirky, very adorable RPGs. There's gay story arcs. There's trans characters in it. I'm not going to spoil too much, but there's a scientist that gives a girl ghost the body of a male robot superstar because that's what she wanted all her life. Mm-hmm. The choices you make do change the ending of the game itself. There's three different play modes. There's the true pacifist mode, which is you play through the game without killing anyone, even wild monsters that attack you. You end up befriending them. The point of the game is you can play by befriending the characters or convincing them to not attack you in some way. There's the one that I didn't try because at the end of the game, that's how powerful the game is. I didn't want to try it at all. Was the genocide route, which is you basically kill everything in sight, kill all the characters. All the adorable little characters, all the adorable little monsters you... And even the not-so-adorable ones, because some of them kind of want to murder you. And even the not-so-adorable, you could just kill everything. And that, of course, is fucked up. But, you know, it's you still have that option. There's the neutral route, which is a little bit of violence. You might kill one or two others. If you can't manage to befriend everyone, or if there's just a character you don't like, you can kill them.
So is this what you think of when you think of an RPG, where it's a bunch of people in a party going on an adventure, and you've got weird friends, and you're in a fantasy land?
Yes and no. That's why I wanted to... that's why a lot of people draw the parallels with the Earthbound series, because whereas regular RPGs like Final Fantasy et al. Are more, you know, classic fantasy, dungeons, dragons, swordplay, magic, etc. And of course, the Western RPGs nowadays that diversified a little bit. You have Skyrim, and right now I'm playing Fallout 4, which is amazing. This one I would just define as quirky and adorable and most of all subversive as fuck. This game is just, I was just surprised at how, you know, even really progressive companies like BioWare, they've been doing a great job representing LGBT people in their games, but this is the first time where I've seen it done perfectly, where... I mean, it's a very lighthearted, there's no gay sex scenes, but it's the most empathic game that I think has ever existed.
So you can play as the bad guy if you're killing everybody, but it sounds like you want to be good. You want to be the altruistic guy who rescues people and saves the day.
That's what's fascinating. I mean, some games that do have that mechanic where you choose to be either quote unquote good or bad. But this is the first time where after I played the true pacifist route and I fell in love with these quirky, adorable, hilarious characters, I felt like I was legitimately forming like a relationship with them to the point that I was like, okay, I played the neutral route, which was the first one because I fucked something up in the beginning. I killed someone I didn't want to kill. I played the true pacifist route, which was amazing. And now I was like, for completion's sake, I should play the genocide route. And I was like, no, I don't want to. I don't want to. I really don't want to. I don't want to see this character, X and Y character, die. I do not want to. I do not want him to die in my hands. As much as I am a super completionist when it comes to video games, I'm the type of person who like will look under every single little rock and get every single little trophy. But at that point, I was like, I can't. And that's not something I could say for other video games.
So you're feeling this intense empathy for the characters. Can you tell me, and I know you want to avoid spoilers, can you tell me about the characters that you felt like the closest connection to?
Well, one of the most amazing was Toriel, who is the first character you meet. She is this kind of goat-like monster, and she's a mother figure. She starts out as a mother figure, and she's just very sweet. She helps you at first. The story starts as you're a child from the human world who falls into this dark pit, into the monster world that's underneath. The humans and the monsters had this war several hundred years ago, I think, or whatever, 1,000 years ago, I don't know. And it ended up with the humans and just locking the monsters away underground, trapped, to avoid another war. And so as a human, you have the choice of either trying to free the monsters or just escaping yourself or just killing them all and freeing them in that way. And you start out with this character who's Toriel, I don't know how it's pronounced, who is this mother figure who helps you. She's very sweet and she's perfectly written. I legitimately felt like I was just, like there was this nurturing character that wanted to protect me from that world outside. There's the quirky skeletons called Papyrus and Sans, which are named after the stupid, ugly fonts everyone hates.
Oh, right.
And they're hysterical. And at first they start out the game trying to kill you because they're supposed to capture and kill humans. But, you know, story unfolds. And like I said, you the game plays as you get to befriend characters. There's Undini, who's, spoiler alert, she's bisexual. She's awesome. There's the quirky nerd scientist, who is also bisexual. There's the, I told you about the transgender ghost / fabulous actor robot who I love that kind of identified with. It's this actor in the monster world who does this TV show. And he's just the most flamboyant, super gay, super fabulous robot that... I definitely play this game. It's like $10. It's worth it. It's on Steam.
When you met that first character, Toriel, did you feel like you were relating to her as a mother character or like more as a friend or like, how do you think of her now?
And I want to draw the parallels to Earthbound, specifically Mother 3, which I'm not sure if you played the Earthbound series, but they make you name all the characters. And so I named the main character as myself, Lucas as myself, and the brother as one of my close friends, and you have the mother character, which I named after my mom. And spoiler alert, it happens pretty early again, you're probably not going to play because it's a Japanese game, but the mom dies horrifically. And I was like, I felt almost like, oh shit, my mom died! I felt like a very intense, like, because of course, I saw it said right there in the text, Annie is dead. And I was like, oh shit. So I kind of felt something like that with Toriel, playing with her. I'm like, there's this motherly character that I couldn't help but, you know, kind of associate with my mom as well, with this nurturing, loving, just protective being, entity.
Yeah, and so games have been a pretty big part of your life, right?
I'd say so. One of the biggest. I mean, my room is a mess, so I can't show you too much, but I can show you some of my game memorabilia. That's Lady Gaga and this cool skeleton art I bought at a flea market. But over there you have this Mario. I'm not sure if you can see it. It's like a fish tank with Mario things in it, the mushrooms and the castle and the piranha plants. And of course, I have all my systems over there. I mean, I've been in a lot of different media have influenced me. Films, of course, I'm an actor, so films, duh. Theater, books. I've been kind of illiterate these days. My resolution last year was to read one book a month. I read one book a year. But hey, baby. Oh, no, I read two. Two, yeah. Yay me. And this year, I'll try to read more. One was, it's funny because it kind of associates with this, what we're talking about here about empathy. It's called Confessions of a Sociopath. It's a memoir written by someone who was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. So basically, they can't feel empathy. And it's fascinating. I've always been fascinated by sociopaths, by these people that can't really connect with other people. They can't feel empathy. And it's fascinating. I definitely recommend it because it's just you see into her mind, you see into her thoughts, how she sees her world. There's that, and I read there is Good Omens, which is hysterical. Have you heard about it? It's
yeah, but tell
Neil,
me, tell
Neil
me
Gaiman
that,
yes. and Terry Pratchett. Mm-hmm. It's about an angel and a demon who are kind of close friends, and the incoming apocalypse. So they lose the Antichrist. The Antichrist is lost. They don't know where it is.
It's so interesting to me that this book that you liked about the sociopath, because, I mean, you're essentially saying that the reason this is appealing to you is so that you can have empathy with someone who will never be able to have empathy themselves.
I'm a kind of pretty emotional person, so I'm very empathic. So for me, it's very fascinating to meet people who just can't feel that and how... And also part of it comes from kind of an envy, because I thought... You know, I suffer from depression and anxiety, as do a lot of millions of people around the world. And part of it comes from, you know, a lot of our suffering comes from other people, of course. You know, humanity, hell is other people, as was it Nietzsche who said that? Hell is other people.
Oh, I think it's from No Exit, but the idea, the play No Exit, but I don't know. It's, I
one of those nihilists, yeah. Whatever. The point is, I love that quote, and it's true. I feel like a lot of human suffering is... It comes from other people, so I thought it would, you know, it'd be great if you could kind of like de-empathize. I don't give a shit about you. Blah. You can't hurt me. I'm powerful, etc.
Do you find empathy is sort of exhausting sometimes for you?
It can be. I find, for example, I was with my boyfriend yesterday. I saw, you know, those little lost dog signs. I was like, oh, every time I see those, like my heart breaks a little bit because I remember when my dog ran away and well, several of my dogs. Ran away, and you know it's always heartbreaking. It's very sad. You know, it's not like the death of a family member, but still, it comes a little bit close to that loss of a precious friend.
And now you know you bring up like Earthbound and Undertale, and I know that there have been a lot of other games for you that had like a lot of emotional resonance. So, what are some of those games that have struck you emotionally that stay with you and if it's so exhausting, like, you know, those you have to, like it's so draining to have those feelings. Why do you like playing them?
Well, I'd say it's cathartic. I can bring up, for example, another game that changed my life forever, Majora's Mask, which I'm not sure if you played. It's Legend of Zelda. It's Link saves the world from the moon that's falling. It's about to murder everyone. It's very dark. Whenever I play it, I feel like it's depression made into a game. It's, you see Link, you see he's suffering, he lost a friend, and there's a lot of fan theories about how the game is actually about the stages of grief, how Clock Town is the depression, and the other one's the swamp is bargaining, and the other one is anger, etc., etc.
And you're like moving through this world. Like the way that you play it is you're moving through sort of a fantasy world and solving puzzles.
For those
puzzles.
Of you who don't know about the game, about the series, it's a action adventure game. You solve these puzzles. There's a story behind it. The point is basically you try to save the world from the apocalypse, and you do so by going back in time. There's a 3-day cycle. Once those 3 days are done, the moon falls. So you have to go back in time to the first day, and all the progress you've done is lost, which is fascinating. It's kind of like a metaphor of life, where you sometimes work very hard for something, and then you lose it, and you have to start over. There's the whole theme of darkness and doom and destruction, of death, which is, you know, inescapable for everyone. It's the common equalizer for all of us. There is a lot of loss, and there's a lot of grief that the characters in the game have go through, and you help them go through. Literally, there's a song that you play called Song of Healing, which you use on certain characters to help heal from their loss or heal from their death. And then you also absorb their powers, and it's really cool. You absorb their powers and become cool animals.
So that game came out, I want to say, like early
2000s? 2001, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and so where were you when you were playing it?
I was in elementary school, actually. Fifth grade, I think. A wee lad.
You're just a boy.
Just a boy in Puerto Rico with nothing to do except worry about why I'm not good at sports and why that boy is making me feel funny in my pants.
So you were kind of a young geek at the time.
Oh, yeah. For sure. Not really that closeted of a geek. Everyone knew I was into video games. I started playing since I was like 4 years old, and then my mom bought us the Super Nintendo, and I played with my sisters and my cousin. We played Super Mario World, which is my favorite Mario platformer. I read in my baby diary, she was like, at first, little Gerardo Enrique, that's my slave name. I'm kidding, that's my full legal name. Little Gerardo Enrique, his sisters were teaching him all the tricks, and then 1 year later, he's teaching them all the tricks. So I really became an avid gamer at a very young age.
Why was it that games resonated with you? Because back then they were not as, you know, advanced as they might be today. And I don't know if they were as emotionally compelling as a modern game might be. But did you have that experience? Did you find like these games were doing something for you?
Well, yeah, I guess being a kid, you know, these simple storylines, rescue the princess, save the world, etc., were enough for me to make an emotional connection with them. I'm pretty sure that if I, at that age, you know, when I was 5-6 years old, if I played Undertale, I'd be like, oh, that's a cute game, okay, that's great. But you know, I think as gamers have emotionally matured, games have also, what's it called, the Walking Dead game is so good, it's amazing, and it's another emotionally destroyed, like I was devastated with that game.
When you were in fifth grade and you're playing Majora's Mask, you're playing this game that's kind of taking you through the stages of grief without ever actually saying that it's doing that. And you mentioned that you were at the time, you know, very aware of not being good at sports like the other boys. Like, were you yourself, like, did you have stress that game was helping you deal with?
Absolutely. Well, actually, when I was in sixth grade, my parents divorced. And I was 12 years old, so that was, you know, pre-puberty, I'm about to enter puberty, I felt like my world kind of fell apart. You know, I had this structure. My previous life was like Ocarina of Time, this like classic little cute game, and all of a sudden, oh shit, the moon's about to fall. What's up? What's down? You know? And that's actually when I got my first major depressive episode after my parents' divorce. So when I was playing this game, I felt like I am this character, this world is falling apart. My choice is I can either work to save it and deal with grief head on and heal any way that I can, or just let the moon fall. Sometimes you have to start over. Sometimes all these cool things you collected, you lose when you start over. People lose things. We lose things all the time. You start over. We keep the rock keeps rolling down the hill, and we just need to keep pushing it up. you feel joy because being, you know, even though it's a very dark game, it has its fun moments. It's a very quirky game at points. I explain how at one point you go back to the first day, but at the end of the game when you're about to beat the bad guy, I felt like I had these three days to save as many characters as I could. I think that's one of the first games where I felt actual empathy with a lot of the characters, because there's the couple that is separated because one of them was cursed and turned into a little boy, and you need to bring them together. There's the little girl that is about to be abducted by aliens. There's all these characters with problems that you have to help, that you have to save. And the crushing thing is you can't save them all. Literally, it's impossible to beat the game because there's different points. You can't be at two places at the same time. You have to either make the choice of saving the cowgirl or saving the mayor from the two people that are bickering and have him behave with his wife. Or you have to save the other character that's about to be killed, or, you know, for me, I felt like I want to try to save as many, like, my favorite characters and the coolest characters. I'm going to try to save as much of them and then beat the game. And I felt like that was the happiest ending. Instead of just skipping everything, going to the third day and beating it, which everyone just still ends up with problems. Some of them die, some of them are separated, some of them never find a true love. I felt like I want to try to help as many people as I can and then beat it. And that's when I felt this is an amazing game, because no other game, you know, other games you just play to get the gold or to get the reward. But I felt like in this game, the reward in itself was just the emotional happiness of helping these people, of making that little world a little better place. At the same time, dealing with your own grief. That's why I felt like I connected a lot with me in my life, and specifically in that point in time. And I still play nowadays. I've beaten it like 20 times. I just got the 3D version, which is perfect.
When you were saving those characters, did you feel like the game was also saving you?
I'd say so. And I'm not sure if you've seen that. Oh, that's another one I wanted to mention. Inside Out. Holy shit. Best Pixar movie ever made. And made me ugly cry. And very few movies have made me ugly cry, by the way. There's Cinema Paradiso and Milk and Inside Out. And the thing is, I don't want to... Because have you seen the movie?
I haven't, not
no,
yet.
No, see it. It's amazing. The point is, one of the central problems in the movie is there's the emotion that no one really likes, which is sadness. You know, who the hell likes sadness? Sadness seems kind of like the useless emotion, versus anger helps you when things are unfair, and disgust helps you not get poisoned and die, and fear helps you not, you know, die and fall off a cliff or get stabbed. And happiness, of course, joy makes you happy. But then what's the point of sadness? And I'm not going to spoil too much, but at the end you see why sadness sticks around. And I feel like that's also the core of empathy. When we help others, we feel, at least empaths, when we help others, we feel a little better ourselves.
Do you feel like that gives you some permission to feel sadness when you feel it?
Absolutely. I mean, oftentimes I've thought myself as kind of cursed for, you know, suffering from depression and anxiety. But really, without suffering, there is no joy. Without suffering, we can't empathize. You can sympathize. You can say, oh, I'm sorry your wife died. Oh, I'm really sad. If you need me, I'll be there. But if you've had your wife die, if you've felt that, or if you've had someone very close to you die, it's a connection that brings people together. And I think that is the essence of understanding and compassion. It's by experiencing loss, we experience what it's like to be human.
Have you connected with other people who've played Majora's Mask or other games that were important to you? And like when you make those connections with people, what is it like?
Just fangirling. Classic fangirling. I'm actually a member of... Oh, wait, you're there too. The LA Gaming Society, which is... LA Gaming Society.
With a Y.
With a Y. It's just a bunch of geeks, gay geeks, and we get together and we'll fangirl over our favorite games. Of course, I'm like kind of the group, I'm the big Zelda fan. So I'll always bring up Majora's Mask and we'll discuss it and why. It's actually a very polarizing game because it's kind of like a cult hit of the Zelda games. It's not, you know, Ocarina of Time is considered by most the best Zelda, and I see why. Same with Wind Waker. It's one of the, like, those two are kind of the top tier. And other people will swear, like me, we will swear that Majora's Mask is the best of all of them. Very different, though, in different ways. Like I said, there's this whole emotional depth to it.
What did your life look like at that time? Like, where were you still living in Puerto Rico, and who were you living with?
Well, it was, I was living in Puerto Rico, and I lived with my mom and my sisters. I was 12. I was in Catholic school. Whoopsh, whoopsh. Mm-hmm. Mea culpa, mea gran culpa. Oh, Catholic guilt. It was, you know, not the best place for a young gay boy or soon-to-be gay boy. I didn't fully realize I was gay until I was, like, 14, or, like, having homosexual desires.
Mm-hmm.
Until I was, like, 14. So it was a tough environment to grow up. I'm very geeky. I am, like, an academic. I am a total dork in many ways. So I never really felt like I fit in with a lot of my peers. That ended up being a blessing in disguise, because it you know, it kind of made me more easily define myself who I was later on when college came, which was the best. And I was able to be gay, and like so many gay people, woo, gay people that are into geeky stuff, yay, not just like 60 other classmates in Catholic school.
So it sounds like, you know, when you're in a very familiar experience to people growing up in a small town, and you're like, oh, I like geeky things, and nobody else does. And then suddenly you find this place, maybe it's college, maybe it's something else, where you
LAGS, or LA Gaming Society.
Yeah, you can just kind of explode with gayness and geekiness at the same time.
Is that what happens to you in college?
Yeah,
it was kind of like that, because, you know, we've all went through the whole, like, high school, elementary school experience where your job is to kind of like survive and fit in, etc. And then college came, and there was just exactly gay geeky explosion. Where we're like, I studied biology; that was my major. So I was also a member of the biologist association, and we would all geek out about geeky biology things and science things. And I actually brought this, which is another media. Not as entertaining for a lot of you, maybe, but this is a book written by the late Dr. Juan A. Rivero, who's mm-hmm. a professor of evolutionary biology. May he rest in peace. And he wrote this book called The Biology of Sex, which when I was coming out in college, it was a pivotal moment of my coming out process, because, well, the internet helped too, but this was the first time where I saw this academic say, hey, you know what? It's still a topic that is being investigated, but same-sex sexual behaviors and homosexuality in humans is a normal, natural thing. And little by little, we're investigating the cause. So far, the research shows that it's probably a mix of genetics and environment. Or in other words, for you biology geeks, epigenetics, which is the hot new thing in in the biology world. And it was the first time where I could just open this book and be like, science says being gay is cool. Oh, by the way, here's this hilarious in the chapter about homosexuality. Sorry, audio readers. Here are two homosexual men. Isn't that hysterical?
Oh my goodness. Describe this picture for folks.
Okay, so there's these two bearish dudes. One of them has a mustache, of course, the 70s porn stash. The other one has a full-on goatee. They have two shirts that say mio with arrows pointing towards each other. And mio means mine, which is adorable. And underneath it says, figure 8-1, two homosexual men. And I saw that and I fucking died, because I was like, this is hysterical. This just, I feel like we would find them in the Castro hanging out, or like in WeHo or Silver Lake at Akbar. And I was just like, there we go. That's a very good picture of two homosexual men.
Were you like, oh, it's me, but not exactly?
No, that's the thing. Well, during my coming out process, I was like, who the hell am I? And of course, I was like, maybe I'm not them. But as I was started associating with more geeky gay guys and lesbians, because lesbians are awesome, the geeky lesbians were my favorite in college. And I started defining myself, and the basis of all this was when I was going through the whole coming out process, especially to people that, some of my friends that were not that educated about it, or to my dad, for example, who didn't grow up in the most tolerant environment. My mom and my sisters, they were easy. They're super gay friendly. But I, as for me as a kind of as a scientist, I needed to find kind of like a lawyer in a courtroom. I needed to use logic and facts to explain why being gay was okay to people like my dad and friends that were detractors. And this just, how more perfect is it? And it says, hey, look, science says being gay is cool. So fuck you. You suck. You're wrong.
you mentioned having some.
By the way, can I curse? I know it's late, but can I curse in your thing?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yay, fuck shit, titties. Okay, that's out of my system.
You mentioned having some exposure to Catholic guilt as a child. Were you feeling guilty about being gay?
Oh, absolutely. Growing up, I call them the 3 years from hell. When I was 14 through 17, I was feeling these desires towards, you know, some of my classmates and like my mom and my sister's cosmopolitans with the shirtless guys in it. And, you know, I was going through that whole like, oh, maybe I'm bisexual, but no, that's a sin. I'm going to go to hell and et cetera. Yeah, there was definitely Catholic guilt just because you grow up thinking that there's this fiery inferno that may or may not exist, that you might go in it if you look at a shirtless guy on your mom's Cosmopolitan magazine, or if you, you know, et cetera. What's all the other gay things we do? Oh, right, anal sex. If you do anal sex, you're going to hell and et cetera. So it was kind of a breaking down of all those conventions I grew up with and kind of creating this my new world. What's my world? That was my old world, I feel. I'll go back to it. I'll visit it. But what's my new world? And my new world was, you know, college. And then after that, New York, when I went to my first gay pride parade, which was the best.
Tell me about that.
Oh, so on my third year, for the summer, I did this summer research internship in marine biology in Delaware. Sorry, Delawareans, but your state sucks. So bored. Beautiful state, but oh, so bored. Nothing to do. So I decided it was Gay Pride week, and I'm like, oh, I've never been to Gay Pride. In Puerto Rico, there's San Juan Pride, but that's like 2 hours away from where I live, so I was never able to go. So I'm like, I want to go, New York. I went. I stayed in this crappy little motel. No, it was a hostel. Crappy little hostel. And that was just the gay explosion. I was like, holy crap. Gayness. So much gayness. All around me. Not just like in a book or in TV. It's like gayness everywhere. And I met up with a bunch of my friends. I had an amazing time. And that's, I feel like, where my life changed, where a lot of this like mold that I've like the small city mold of like you grow up and you like you can be gay whatever, but you can be like a lawyer or a scientist but never an artist. That's when I decided, you know, fuck that. The world's such a big place. The world is bigger than Mayagüez, Puerto Rico. And as much as I love it, as much as I love my city where I grew up in and all the people, the beautiful people that live in it, I felt like I didn't fit in and I needed to find my own path and my own world. And that's where it started, when I experienced somewhere other than the island I grew up in.
What you're describing, that discovering your path and creating your world, making decisions, it sounds like exactly what you were describing when you were talking about Undertale. Yeah. It sounds like you were having like a little mini Undertale of your own there in your like late adolescence.
Basically, yeah.
So you were going to school for biology, and then you decided to make a switch to acting, or like, what? How did you roll that change out?
Well, I always loved it, and it started in high school. I would always do, you know, little plays, and
why did you like acting?
That's a good question. I can list like the top five happiest moments of my life. Three of them, at least, it'll be me on stage or me in front of a camera or me doing a silly YouTube video. Easily, because I just, there's something, maybe it's because I love escapism, clearly, but something about playing another person, you know, experiencing for a fleeting moment what it's like to be another person, even if it's just for like one scene where you lose yourself and you forget who you are and all of a sudden you become this person. There's something amazing about that.
You mentioned that some of your happiest moments, or maybe most fulfilling moments, were on stage or in front of a camera. What are those roles? Like, what are the ones that really stick with you?
Well, the first one was when I played Smeagol, in other words, Gollum from Lord of the Rings. That was my first, actually, big role in the talent show in high school.
And that's a dark character.
It was terrifying. The feeling of being in the spotlight, as much, it was kind of this push and pull, like, oh, it sounds so amazing, I want it. But at the same time, like, so I remember when my cue came to, was, which, to, I remember I jumped out in front of the audience. I was in the audience kind of sitting out of nowhere, and I just jumped and the spotlight was on me. I remember feeling like I was going to have a heart attack and die. And I remember just being frozen. And there was my cue, and they just needed to hear my, precious, and then the spotlight would come onto me. Oh, and it was awesome. I shaved my head for it. I'm very into, like, getting super into character, so I shaved my head and put, like, then makeup all over. It was fucking gross, but amazing. I remember just being terrified, and it was just that pure adrenaline when I finally jumped out and...
What was, you know, for all the anxiety that you were feeling, what was pulling you to on stage? Like, what was drawing you out?
Just the best was hearing people's reactions. Just that's one of the reasons why, as much as I love film and I love acting in front of a camera, nothing beats having an audience laughing and cheering or crying, or it's just... But yeah, it's kind of like just feeling that feedback of what you're doing, which is, you know, we all like that. No matter what you do, whether you're a carpenter or a poet or an actor or a judge, everyone likes, you know, receiving feedback for what they do.
Do you feel like you kind of forget who you are sometimes when you're in a role? Like you've just become some other character?
Depends. Yeah, I mean, oh God, there was one scary role where I played a serial killer for this play that never got to be. And that one was kind of scary because I felt, at one point I felt, I'm kind of losing myself in this very fucked up person. And that's why that book I read, The Confessions of a Sociopath, was so good. That was actually helped me a lot for my role because, I don't know, I mean, we all heard of what's his face? He did Joker.
Heath Ledger.
They're saying that a lot of the things that led to his mental health issues were the fact that he had to act out this incredibly fucked up person, and it does kind of, part of me, you feel a little bit of that, I don't know, like that, because of course, you know, I'm more of a, like, emotional actor. I like really enveloping myself in the character, and that's a scary place to go. It's scary to think, I want to kill this person, I want to strangle them. It's kind of like tapping into that dark part of our being, that part we all try to keep, like our id. It's like tapping into your id, into the savagery and the bloodlust, and it's a scary place to go. So yeah, I feel like there's the two sides of that coin. It's awesome to be in other characters, but it can also be kind of scary, which is amazing, really. It's part of the human condition.
And it's not something that you'd really have a reason to explore, say, if you were still in biology, you know?
Of course.
Seldom does a biologist have a reason. So it sounds like acting kind of gives you permission to explore a level of empathy that you wouldn't otherwise have.
Yeah, I'd say that, absolutely.
That's something that's helped you, you know, when you're talking about Majora's Mask, you know, having empathy with those characters and the game giving you permission to explore sadness.
Mm.
Do you come back to Majora's Mask when you might be going through a sad period now?
Yeah, I do. Actually, for 2015, which was... again, the worst year of my life. I that's when the 3D remake came out, and I played it as I was going through this very tough time. And I, just like before, I felt this process of, I mean, it wasn't the same because I basically have the game memorized, but of course, seeing the fresher graphics and playing that again and feeling at least an emulation of those emotions I felt was still very cathartic.
What made 2015 so difficult?
Oh God, it's a long story, but. My day job used to be teaching. I used to be a teacher, and a long time ago, even before I taught, I made this video that's a little risque on my YouTube channel. It's comedy, but like there's a dildo in it. And long story short, I basically lost my job. I tutored also as my main source of income. I lost a lot of my clients. I was eventually evicted because... it was a very difficult time, and I ended up very sick. I ended up hospitalized, actually, and because of all the, you know, it was a lot of friends abandoned me during that point. They basically said that they didn't want my negative energy to affect them, and that they were basically babysitting them, and that it was hard to like see me suffer. So, you know, that was also kind of a purging moment where I was like, you know what, fuck you guys. You know, one of those moments in life where you it really tests who your real friends are. So yeah, it was a very difficult time. I lost a lot of friends. I lost a lot of my clients. I lost my job. I lost my economic safety net. But I also gained a lot of things, and it led to what so far has been a pretty good year. So I met this amazing person that I would not have met if I didn't go through that process. Because I think I met him at a pool party that I went to, that I was able to go to because I didn't have a job, so I was free that Saturday. So, you know, it's weird. Life finds a way to come around, I feel.
It seems like Majora's Mask was there for you at the right time again. That you have sort of an emotional muscle memory of going through this game that just came out, updated and refreshed.
Yeah.
So there's a newness to it, and yet it's, you know, familiar friends, familiar feelings, rescuing people again. And tell me about, you said 2016, so far, it's been a little better.
Yeah, thankfully.
So you
new boyfriend, new love, yeah. Things are looking pretty good. I've been working on this video that I love. You're going to love it. It's very geeky. It's very video game related. It's a parody video of a Sia song. Another one, because it's my second one. And it's featuring video game characters. And I've had so much fun. I wrote it, and I'm producing it. And I play Link, of course. And that, I feel like, has been one of the most fun parts of 2016 so far, shooting those scenes. And the latter part of evil fucking year 2015 was also had those little peppered happy moments and fun moments.
So you're working on this very gay and very video game themed project, and I have to assume it's with other people who you have those two things in common.
No, it's with puppets. No, yeah, it's with other people. Working with really cool people is the best. Like when things really gel together and you have all these like-minded individuals, because I've worked with people before where they're just, you know, no one's really having fun, and they're like, when can we be done, and we're in a hurry. So this has been a breath of fresh air, working with really cool, super talented people that are awesome and have similar interests.
Well, I was going to say that one of the reasons that seems like it's working for you is because you're such an empathetic person, and it's so important to you to be able to make an emotional connection with folks. And these are clearly folks who have stood by you and are still in your life because they are making an empathetic connection with you, whether it's good times or bad times. Because when bad times are happening, I mean, that's when you find out who your friends are.
Absolutely. That's true.
Well, so if people want to see your work, where can they find you?
YouTube. You have to search. I don't have enough followers to merit the shiny little youtube.com/ thing. But search Dorksided, DorkSided.
And you have some videos on there that have gotten pretty popular.
I have one that was my first Sia video that... Oh my god, that was amazing. So it's Sia, bless her heart, I adore her, one of my favorite artists, but sometimes you can't understand what the fuck she's saying. I love her, adore her, but there's this, I remember when her new CD came out, which is amazing, there was this one particular song called Burn the Pages, where I could not understand what the fuck she was saying. And I was like, what is she saying? So I wrote down, like, what are these lyrics? And I wrote down what I thought she was saying, or what it's kind of sounded like. And I was like, this is funny, I want to make a video out of it. So I made it. I got some of my friends together. We filmed it at my house. It was really fun. But just little tiny little 100, 200 views. Okay, cute. Like, my friends and my family saw it. They liked it. They seemed to have good reception. And then I have one friend who knows Sia's manager, and he's like, "Oh my god, this video is really fun. I'm gonna send it to him." He sent it to him. He sent it to her. And then one day, when I'm really depressed, doing my taxes and being like, "This sucks. I hate fucking taxes," someone texts me, "Oh my god, open your Facebook right now and your Twitter." I opened the Facebook and Twitter, and Sia posted, "Oh my god, this video sent me to Giggly Town," and posted the link, and then the video got so many views. It was amazing, and people were commenting, and I was like, And then one day, one shitty, rainy, taxes-making day turned into the best internet day of my life. That was such a good internet day. You know those really good internet days where just really good stuff is happening, either like gay marriage is legal or your video was tweeted by Sia. Like, those are really good internet days.
Fantastic. I'm so happy for it. I'm so happy that happened. And I'm looking forward to this video that you're working on now becoming huge and giving you another good internet day.
Yeah, thank you. I hope to many good internet days to come.
Well, Enrique, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Matt. Thank you so much.
Thanks to Enrique for joining me, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everybody who makes the Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get backer rewards like stickers in the mail and exclusive bonus videos. Also, check out my YouTube for deep dives into pop culture history at youtube.com/mattbaum and my newsletter at mattbaum.com. The theme song for the Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons, Bad Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.